evening. It is Tuesday, May 19th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Here's today's update on the spread of coronavirus in the United States. We have 1.54 million cases confirmed. That's up by 21,287 cases from yesterday. Fortunately, 289,000 people have recovered, and unfortunately, 90,694 people have passed. That is up by 792 people from yesterday. President Donald Trump yesterday sent a four-page letter to Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, threatening to permanently freeze U.S. funding to the United Nations agency in the midst of a global pandemic that has made international cooperation as crucial as ever. This while Chinese President Xi Jinping yesterday pledged $2 billion to the organization to tackle the coronavirus pandemic and said he supported a, quote, global review, end quote, of the international response to the outbreak, but only if it is led by the WHO and only after the virus has been contained. What are we to make of all of this? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guest. He's a political activist, host of the political radio show Mi Casa Es Su Casa, and founder of MCSC Network, Nico House. Nico, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Hey, thanks for having me back on, Doc. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and hopefully you are as well. So the president wrote that the WHO is deferential to China if the organization, quote, does not commit to major substantive improvements within the next 30 days, I will make my temporary freeze of U.S. funding to the WHO permanent and reconsider our membership in the organization, end quote. The president also alleged that the organization ignored early warnings about the spread of the coronavirus and made, quote, grossly inaccurate or misleading, end quote, claims about the virus. Your thoughts, Nico House.
So he actually is correct about their grossly misleading claims. I don't know if you remember, but they had a lot of projections that came out that were inaccurate, if we're being objective. Now, he's also correct that he actually did try to take some action. A Trump supporter corrected me the other day when I thought Trump hadn't done anything to at least March, but it turned out he had started taking steps, significant steps, in January. Now, I also want to say...
Wait a minute, what steps did he take in January? Refresh my memory, because
he had put together a task force to investigate the spread of the virus, how to try and come up with a way to contain it at the time. Now, many people weren't even talking about the coronavirus for whatever reason, and even some of our Congress, our legislators in the Republican and Democratic parties were trying to tell us everything was going to be okay. Nancy Pelosi went to China to say, "Oh, we know we're going to go back home and tell everybody it's going to be okay." Richard Burr wrote that article, and then of course, so did stocks. So, but there was some steps taken, but the WHO really kind of, in my opinion, they fumbled this. But hell, what governmental organization hasn't fumbled at this point?
Well, I would ask also for clarification. You said China put out misleading statements. Were they misleading?
Not China.
Oh, I'm sorry. The WHO, did they put out misleading statements or were they just inaccurate? And the difference I draw there is intent. For me, when you say the statements were misleading, that to me is the WHO intentionally put out wrong information to send you down a different track, as opposed to early on in the game, some of the assessments that they made were inaccurate.
So that's actually a really good question, honestly. You gotta wonder if it was inaccurate or quote-unquote misleading. I think if you're talking about in January, it would be hard to say that they were intentionally misleading people. Now, and on the other side of that coin, you do have to ask some questions. Well, what would it look like if they were misleading people? For example, even now, for example, there for people who have been claiming they want to, that the government is focused on saving lives and the WHO is focused on saving lives and addressing as potential, as many potential solutions as possible. Have they talked about this wonder drug that's been coming out of Cuba that China worked together to create, despite China actually being pretty supportive of the WHO? I haven't seen any information on that, despite that drug having a damn near 100% success rate at this point. Why hasn't anyone, I know a lot of people have been making fun of Trump for taking hydroxychloroquine, but he didn't come up with that idea on his own, because a lot of doctors who are in charge of major medical systems in the United States and the international community have been using hydroxychloroquine with a combination of zinc to treat this. And the issue that we've been seeing is that people immediately jump to make fun of Trump before doing their own research. And if you'd have done your own research, they're making fun of Trump, and in their words, not because they said it would be harmful for him to take it, but, oh, there hasn't been enough research. So why is the United States, for some reason, so invested in this one solution, which is a vaccine, instead of saying, well, even while we're researching the solutions for this, why not look at the solutions that have worked in other scenarios? And why has the WHO been encouraging the United States and other countries to look in that direction where other solutions may be possible as well while we're looking for a vaccine? So then you have, so you do have to question their intentionality, at least now, but in January, it'd be hard to say that they were being directly misleading.
Okay. Okay. The U.S. is preparing to publicly disassociate itself from language in a WHO resolution that will back the right of poor countries to ignore patents in order to gain access to a COVID vaccine or treatment if it is developed. Many governments, particularly in Africa, fear they will be squeezed out by richer countries unless they can force companies that discover anti-COVID-19 therapies to share their intellectual property with manufacturers able to produce them cheaply at scale. This, to me, is key to where the debate is right now, and I don't hear enough discussion about it. This is over profit, and who's going to get paid if and when a vaccine is actually discovered?
You, in my opinion, have hit the nail right on the head. And I mean, let's be honest, this subject is basically a discussion of big pharma, and we already know where their intentionality lies. And let's not play naive. We know historically how the WHO has treated African countries. We also know historically how vaccines have been tested and used on people in Africa. Just the other day, the president of Madagascar said he wants to pull out of WHO because basically for the similar reason that you just outlined. They won't release the patent. And because they won't release that patent, you're basically subject to using the vaccines of companies that you as an African nation may not be that willing to trust, considering the history of these Western nations and how they've treated Africans and the results of those vaccines in those nations. But we can also look at another thing. We can go back to the hydroxychloroquine argument. Do you know who owns the patent for hydroxychloroquine?
I do not.
Well, I was going to say, because people have said that Trump had been invested in it, and that's why he was promoting it. So I was curious. I'm like, oh, it makes sense, right? So I looked it up. Turns out he's only invested $1,500 into it. But that wasn't even the most interesting part. What I found next was the most interesting part. It's owned by a company in France. In other words, a drug that is having an extremely high success rate when combined with a couple of other natural vitamins, all of a sudden isn't owned by the United States. So what happens if the entire world decides to lean on this as one of the main solutions to address the coronavirus? And why at that point hasn't it been researched? Because that's what everybody said. They're making fun of Trump for not, because the drug has not had enough research into it. Why hasn't it had enough research into it? Well, for the same reason that marijuana and kratom, for example, hasn't had enough research into their medicinal properties, because it's very hard to make a lot of money off of something that you cannot get exclusivity on. And that is what a problem. That is a problem we're seeing with this entire COVID-19 pandemic. It isn't I mean, it's a Republican problem, a Democrat problem, it's a gubernatorial problem. But at the heart of the issue, there is a lot of misleading information. A lot of people feel like they're being misled by everybody, and that it's because it's true. And it's because money is guiding the decision making as usual.
One of the issues with hydroxychloroquine has been heart arrhythmia. And that if it's not taken in proper dosages, and if the pre-existing conditions of the patient are not understood, people have been having strokes and heart attacks behind hydroxychloroquine.
Yes, that's true. And that's why you have to make sure you're combining it with the right elements if a person does have a pre-existing condition. But with that being said, I mean, let's be honest. How many pharmaceuticals don't have the exact same warnings? If you have a heart condition, let your doctor know. If you're pregnant, let your doctor know. If you have high blood pressure, let your doctor know before you take it. That because a few people could have an adverse reaction if they have pre-existing conditions doesn't mean we should not research more. If anything, it means that we should be researching more. You know?
Absolutely. But I just wanted to be sure that we did not lose sight of the fact that early on in this process, a lot of folks flocked to hydroxychloroquine, and the FDA, I believe it was either the CDC or the FDA, or maybe it was both, who said, well, we're not sure about the efficacy of this drug, but because we're desperate, go ahead and use it if, as a doctor, you deem it to be necessary or could be beneficial. And then we started finding out that a number of people, I think particularly African Americans, started having strokes and started having heart attacks and heart arrhythmia because of that.
Yeah, and our community unfortunately has we're predisposed to having high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and heart disease, unfortunately. And that's why, once again, to ensure that we don't have people have those adverse effects to it, we need to be researching if this is a possible solution so that we can get it right rather than having Dr. Spitball at the right combination to apply the drug.
And getting back to this profit point, Ellen Tehoen, director of research of a research group, Medicines, Law, and Policy, said it took a decade for African countries to get affordable AIDS medicines, during which time millions of people died. Quote, what we have seen in the past is that high-income countries rush to the front of the queue and leave the rest of the world to fend for themselves, end quote. So what we're seeing here right now, and I found it very interesting that this was being reported in the Financial Times, this whole issue of who's going to have access to patent rights and what's going on right now with the WTO. A lot of mainstream domestic press is making this out to appear as though Donald Trump is just holding the line on the WTO. But when you read the Financial Times, it comes out. I'm sorry, WHO. Thank you. It comes out that, no, it's not that. They're really fighting over patent access.
I think that. Well, so here's my thing, though. If it was about patent access, then you have to once again wonder, then why take hydroxychloroquine if America wouldn't stand to profit at all from that patent? Why would you even promote it? Why would you tell people if that's what's Trump's issue with I don't think it's that with him specifically, but I do believe that that is an issue with our government. But then you have to wonder once again, I know Bill Gates, for whatever reason, decided to donate $20 million to Sub-Saharan Africa to combat the virus. And I'm saying, I see a lot of y'all like, quote unquote, donating money and all that good stuff. However, Africa isn't the one with a pandemic right now. There have been a few cases, and they have actually worked with Cuba and China to keep it under control because they've already dealt with something that did get that big, which was Ebola in that continent. And they handled the situation. Now they have seemingly gotten out ahead of us with dealing with COVID-19. And yet we are not seeing everybody's talking about, well, why won't he consult with the WHO? Why is the WHO consulting with China? Why is nobody consulting with Africa to figure out what they've done to keep this situation under control? Why is no one consulting with Cuba, despite the fact we know that they have one of the top five medical research programs in the world? Why is no one talking about that?
Real quick, because I have talked about it and I have spoken with Nigerian public health officials, and they explained that early on in this program that African countries realized the problem was access to Europe. and that if they were able to control flights into their countries and able to quarantine people that were coming into the country from Europe, that they would be able to get way ahead of this curve. And that to a great degree is what has led them to the successful programs that they're experiencing up to this point.
Yeah, I agree. And that's what's interesting, because in the first person to die of coronavirus in the continent of Africa was a European. It wasn't even an African. It was a European that lives in Africa. So, and they had just gotten back from Europe. But once again, and I'm glad that you brought that up. So these people are telling you, very intelligent people, they have the professional degrees too. They have the experience as well. It's just simply they're not driven by profit motive. So they're just telling you what common sense answers that and solutions that they have used. And yet, as usual, unfortunately, when it comes to the African community, we're completely ignoring them. And it seems like we're more so obsessed with trying to get them to work at our behest rather than saying, hold on, they seem to have gotten this under control. Well, maybe we should bring them in to the solutions process. And everybody is fighting and jockeying for power and control to see who gets the rights to this quote unquote solution that, of course, will be administered around the world. Instead of one, let's check out the solutions we have right now. Two, why aren't we, if we are looking for a solution, why aren't we allowing research, or no, matter of fact, why aren't we encouraging research into multiple solutions? And three, why are we ignoring the countries who are saying they have solutions? You know what I'm saying? Like Cuba.
Absolutely.
Or China was working with Cuba, et cetera. Why are we ignoring them completely? It's beyond, oh, we're just not going to work with Cuba because of the embargo, and that will put too much of a tension on the relationship. But it's just completely ignored.
It's a combination of profit motive and geopolitical politics. That's in the geopolitical landscape. Nico House, I got to get out. Hey, thank you so much, as always, for your time. Look forward to having you back. Stay healthy, please.
Appreciate it, man. You too.
All right. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. As President Trump continues the removal of inspectors general, the firing of State Department IG Steve Linnick might be the most problematic. It is now being reported that Linnick had been investigating Secretary of State Mike Pompeo personally, as well as a major decision Pompeo had approved on an arms deal with Saudi Arabia. Both the White House and Pompeo have said the removal of Linnick was Pompeo's call. Why is this problematic? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guests. First, she's an attorney and former editor-in-chief of Inside Arabia, Elizabeth Myers. Elizabeth, as always, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Wilmer.
And we're also joined by a professor of political science, and he teaches constitutional law at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Professor David Schultz. David, as always, welcome back.
It's my pleasure and pleasure to always to talk to your audience.
So, Elizabeth, let me start with you. Explain to the audience what an IG actually does.
So it's a very important principle that we have inspectors general in all of the federal agencies and a number of other parts of the government. They are, by their very nature and by their design, supposed to be independent and objective oversight instruments to ensure that whatever agency or military or Pentagon or whatever they're supposed to be overseeing is not doing fraud, abuse, waste, or misconduct. It's and David can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that we first had inspectors general of the United States, the federal, coming in just after the Watergate scandal. And it is a very essential part of our notion of checks and balances, that we have a powerful executive that also needs to be kept in check. And this is one of the means that we have devised under our constitutional system of law to do that.
David, same question to you. And with Elizabeth having said that the IG is independent and objective, I found it very interesting listening to the president. I think it was yesterday. He was very clear saying, oh, well, one would expect if the IG is appointed by the previous administration, especially if the administration is from the other party, oh, they're going to be biased and we got to get rid of them. Everybody would understand that. I mean, that's what I took from some of the things that the president said yesterday.
Well, that's what the president said, and the president basically got it wrong. Sort of two or three quick observations here. One is Elizabeth caught it exactly correct, that the IGs basically are created post-Watergate to address both graft, corruption, fraud, and abuse that we found in the Nixon administration, including misspending of funds, misallocation, not spending of it. And they're supposed to be independent and objective. And so that's the clear context. And what I take away from Trump's dismissal of him, his most recent one, he was fired, that is, the inspector general, for the very reason why he was there. That is, to root out fraud and to root out misallocation of funds. And part of why they're set up the way they are, the inspector generals, so that they carry over through administrations, is so that presidents don't put in their own cronies, put in their own people who they're beholden to. So on so many different scores, the president basically got it wrong. But this has been, I think, the message of his entire administration. He thinks that the presidency, the executive branch, is just one unified body of which he's the CEO, and he gets to do whatever he wants. And he forgets there's what things called checks and balances, separation of powers, that are, as Elizabeth pointed out, that are supposed to place those limits.
Elizabeth, Steve Bannon, former White House chief strategist, told us early on in the Trump campaign that Trump's focus would be the deconstruction of the administrative state. Are actions like this consistent with that mindset? I mean, Linick is the third IG to be shown the door in 6 weeks.
Actually, I think he's the fourth, isn't he? Yes. This is, I think, this whole, one of the things I was going to say on this call is this continued dismantling of the machinery of government oversight and the chipping away at the balance of powers that our Constitution holds fundamental. And I think you're absolutely right that basically Trump from the beginning, and Bannon has caught it, has treated our government like a privately held business with zero accountability. Or if you want to put that into government terms, like an absolute monarch. And we do not have that. The notion that America has one person with absolute power is absolutely false. We ditched that idea with our independence almost 300 years ago. We're not going back to that. Our Constitution will not let us. But he's been trying to chip away at this power. But I am confident, and I hope that David agrees with me as a constitutional scholar, that our Constitution and our system of democracy is much stronger and much more intact than anything Trump and his cronies in the Republican Party can do over the next 6 months.
David, as I come to you to answer Elizabeth's question, I would say she's absolutely right. But the problem is that the Constitution has to be enforced. It has to be interpreted. And up to this point, the president has been given an incredible amount of latitude, not only by the Republicans, but by the Democrats as well. And I want to reiterate, Steve Bannon told us, deconstruction of the administrative state. And that jumped out at me as soon as Bannon said it. I think it went over the head of a lot of people.
I think you're right. I'm going to add even one more blame to it. I mean, clearly the Republicans, when they controlled both in the House and the Senate, gave the president a blank check, proving that party was more powerful than separation of powers, which was the fear that our framers had about the role of parties. But even with the Democrats in place, you know, taking over in the House, they've had some limited success. But the real fear that I have, and I thought where you were going to go for a second here, is not only to say does the Constitution
I was leaving it for you to go
enforced,
there.
Yeah, is it has to be interpreted. And this is a Supreme Court that has so far has given the president a major pass on a whole range of issues. And we're going to see in the next few weeks how much more of a pass they're going to give him, because we had argued last week a case all about access to the president's income taxes, for example, where Congress wants to be able to do this as part of its oversight functions. And this is going to give us a pretty good picture. My hope of separation of checks and powers, checks and balances, I should say, is that the courts are going to step in and do their job and do exactly what Elizabeth says. But I'm fearful that this is a court, especially with two Trump appointees, that are going to give him a lot more slack than he should have.
Can I just jump in there, too? Because that's where I thought you were going to. And I am hopeful that even with two Trump appointees on the court will recognize that if it undermines the checks and balances of powers that we have under the Constitution in this particular case that David's talking about, it not only undermines Congress's power, but it undermines the court's power, because the court is a co-equal branch of government. And I hope we do have, you know, there are constitutional scholars on that court. And I do hope that that will be one of the things that they recognize is a huge danger in denying congressional oversight in this particular case.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to be sure we get to actually the point of the discussion, which is Pompeo and the president fired the IG. Is this going to, and the IG was investigating Pompeo at the time. Is this, David Shultz, a problem for Pompeo going forward?
It should be a problem in a year, in normal circumstances. An event like this would probably lead to what? Pompeo being dismissed or fired, or real significant PR problems and congressional investigations. But this is not a normal year, partly because a story like this goes under the radar with the Trump mishandling of the coronavirus. At the same time, I think the public has almost become, I don't know, numb to the fact of what? Another scandal, another problem. And so I want to say potentially, yes, this is a major problem for him. But the president's not going to fire him. The president's not going to get rid of him. Pompeo is a loyal Trumpista. And so in terms of losing his job, no. In terms of it affecting the election, people have already made up their minds one way or the other about how they think about Trump and all his scandals.
Elizabeth Meyer, same question to you. Is this a problem for Pompeo?
Well, again, it should be. But for the very same reasons, I don't think so. We know that Trump doesn't think it's a big deal for him to be asking, for Pompeo to be asking his personal staffers to do his laundry run or his walking the dog or anything like that. Not an issue. He doesn't understand. And therefore, whatever Pompeo is doing is going to be fine with him. But what's really disturbing to me is the rationale that Pompeo gave and the lack of rationale that Trump gave. And this is something that the American public should be aware of. Pompeo said the rationale for firing the guy was he was not doing what we wanted him to do. And again, we just talked about the whole purpose of the IG's offices and all of the agencies is independence and objectivity. They're not supposed to do what you want them to do, especially when they're investigating you. And on the other hand of that, Trump said, they told me to do it and I did it. He gave zero justification for firing him, and he didn't even know the reasons why. This is very disturbing. And to go a step beyond, if this is an act of retaliation, or because this was an Obama appointee, or because he was investigating Pompeo and or Trump, this cannot become the new normal. People cannot believe that this is normal. It is not normal.
It was also said that he was fired because there was a pattern of unauthorized disclosures and leaks to the news media about investigations, but they were not able to provide any evidence that Linick was actually involved in any of that. I got to get out here. Elizabeth Myers, as always, thank you. Professor David Schultz, as always, thank you. Y'all stay safe and healthy. Look forward to having you back.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Pompeo warns ICC, the International Criminal Court, of quote-unquote consequences if it probes Israeli war crimes. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has threatened that Washington will exact consequences if the ICC moves ahead with a potential war crimes investigation into Israel. In response to this, a bipartisan group of U.S. House and Senate legislators sent separate letters to Pompeo urging him to defend Israel, a firm U.S. ally, against ICC investigations, saying the tribunal's assertion amounted to a politicalization of the court's mission. According to my next guest, it is time to confront the U.S. rogue state. He is the co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace and former VP nominee for the Green Party, Ajamu Baraka. As always, Ajamu, welcome back.
My pleasure.
So you've written a piece entitled No Justice, No Peace, Time to Confront the U.S. Rogue State, wherein you give a rundown of the current global state of affairs, and you list, I think it's five different issues. If you would touch on those five so we can get a good understanding of the issues before us.
Well, thank you so much for having me again. What you are referencing is the piece that just came out yesterday from the Black Alliance for Peace from the National Coordinating Committee. Well, we are saying basically that global humanity must recognize that we have a collective threat. And unfortunately, that threat is emanating from the U.S. state. And so we said that we have to confront this power because its pursuit of its own national interest seems to be at the detriment of everyone else. It has no hesitation operating as a rogue state, a state that completely goes beyond the legal norms in order to pursue its particular objective. So we point some of those out. We say we are in the midst of a global pandemic, and there was a proposal from the United Nations to have a global ceasefire while we confront COVID-19. But the U.S. resisted and undermined that effort. But they didn't stop themselves from engaging in another kind of activity. That is to threaten, as you just read, the International Criminal Court for having the audacity to consider looking at war crimes by the Israeli state against the Palestinian people. We talked about the fact that the U.S., this is a bipartisan process. We talked about the fact that the Obama administration committed $1 trillion to upgrade the U.S. nuclear arsenal. The Trump administration then decided to pull out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty to allow themselves to redeploy short-range missiles on the border of Russia and China. We talked about reminding people about the NATO attack on Libya. And we go on and on. Syria, you know, Honduras. We demonstrate that this rogue state status is not something that can be put at the feet of Donald Trump, but it's been a bipartisan policy orientation of the U.S. state for the last decade and a half.
And it's also important to realize that in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic as the UN was trying to broker a global ceasefire, U.S. arms manufacturers are reaping record profits.
Exactly. The commerce and death and destruction continues. And the U.S. is quite ready to oppose any attempts to try to impose restraints through the arms trade treaty. Again, this is these are examples of why international public opinion consistently, year after year, identifies the U.S. state as the number one threat to global peace. And this shameful act on the part of the U.S. Congress, and it's important to again, stress the fact that this was a bipartisan demand that was made to Secretary of State Pompeo to resist International Criminal Court and to call into question its legitimacy. This is after the International Criminal Court has been accused of being a pawn or instrument of the U.S. And Western powers ever since it was first put in place. But now that it is attempting to try to exercise some degree of objectivity and looking at Israel, now all of a sudden it's illegitimate. It's very, very shameful.
And you mentioned in this piece, for the people of the world, it is quite clear the United States is the primary threat to global peace. And you've said that a number of times during this interview. I think it's important for people to understand that that is not just hyperbole. This is not over-the-top rhetoric. I go back to, I can't recall the year off the top of my head, but I do remember very clearly that former South African President Nelson Mandela made that very same point. I want to say it was on the cover of Time magazine, that the United States is the greatest threat to world peace. So if the beloved Madiba, if Nelson Mandela can make that statement, you're in pretty good company.
I appreciate that comment. But you know what? Also, Dr. Leon, this can be empirically verified. Your listeners can go to the internet, Google International Gallup poll on threats to international peace. Every year it is documented through the Gallup polling that the international public sees the U.S. as the greatest threat to world peace. So this is not just a Jamo Baraka going off. This is documented empirically by these international polls.
How is the predatory relationship between the U.S. and the rest of humanity best captured in Trump's America First policy?
That basically, it doesn't really matter to U.S. policymakers how their policies may have a detrimental impact on the rest of humanity. They are committed to advancing U.S. interests. And many people point to Trump's slogan, America First, as though it is a new policy. But we say that it's always been America First. The only difference is that the Trump administration is a little bit more crude and open in their articulations of that position. But they have always been committed to advancing U.S. interests to the detriment of everyone else, including not providing leadership during this COVID-19 crisis, not providing leadership when it comes to addressing the issue of climate change, reversing all of the safeguards put in place to put constraints on the use of nuclear weapons. The U.S. is moving to remove those constraints, including renegotiating and extending the START treaty that's scheduled to end in February of 2021 because they have aspirations to deploy missiles around Russia and China. So these kinds of policies that are advancing U.S. interests are the ones that are also seen as threats to the international public and to states around the planet. So this is why we say we have to confront the rogue state status of the U.S. and demand that activists in the U.S. demand that the U.S. adhere to international standards and international law and stop being the biggest threat of the world peace on the planet.
As you talk about the America First policy, that's just a slightly more juvenile, I would say, manifestation of manifest destiny, of American exceptionalism, American internationalism. These are ideologies or concepts or taglines that have been used since the inception of the country. And talk about that in the context of the Space Force, because one of the things that I found very interesting was a day or two ago during a White House briefing or press conference on COVID-19, the president unfurls the Space Force flag. And I'm thinking to myself, this is just utter insanity compounded by insanity, multiplied by insanity.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dr. Leon. It's madness. But it's even more mad that there's not more opposition. And again, it's not just the Trump administration. There's been discussions around militarizing the space for quite some time. And you might recall, many of your listeners might remember, you know, the last major attempt on the part of the U.S. was during the Reagan administration and so-called Star Wars. So this is something that's been out there, that you have major corporations that would like to be allowed to colonize parts of space in order to get certain precious minerals. So this is just part of the madness that is projected as rationality. And again, it says why we have to have a shift of power, that as long as these elements have this power that they have, they become a threat not only to themselves, but to everyone else. And I wanted to step back for a second, too, in terms of this international threat. The issue of sanctions and the fact that there have been numerous requests that in the midst of this COVID-19 catastrophe, that the U.S. sanction regime that is causing untold suffering in places like Venezuela and Iran, that those sanctions should be loosened to allow for these countries to at least address this pandemic. But no, instead, they have even tightened the sanctions on countries like Venezuela. Again, this is another example of the kind of callousness that we see coming from this administration, but moral bankruptcy coming from the representatives of the people who don't oppose the Trump administration and those policies. As a matter of fact, you have people like Joe Biden who are positioning themselves from the right of Trump on issues like China and Cuba. So this is, again, the bipartisan nature of the madness of the U.S. And the fact that the U.S. represents this almost existential threat to global humanity.
And you have not only Joe Biden to indicate that this is not a Donald Trump issue. This is not a Republican partisan issue. I keep saying this because I want people to understand the severity of this sickness. You've got Nancy Pelosi back in the play in Venezuela. You've got Elizabeth Warren on record back in the play in Bolivia. And now even our beloved Ilhan Omar has moved off of her position and is finding space and tolerance with AFRICOM in Somalia.
Exactly. And that's unfortunate. But, you know, Dr. Leon, what that reflects too when it comes to people like Representative Omar, it's a reflection of the weakness of the movement in the U.S. Because the movement is so weak, there's no accountability. So these representatives can take these kinds of questionable positions with impunity. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do with the Black Alliance for Peace. We have a campaign to shut down AFRICOM, and we are attempting to try to have a dialogue with a Representative Omar's office. We met with her once on this issue. We know that she has a better position, but again, without sufficient pressure on her and others who have an ability to say something positive, they would drift and make the kind of comments she made last week vis-a-vis AFRICOM.
Ajamu Baraka, Black Alliance for Peace, justice.com is where you go to read more detail. No justice, no peace. Time to confront the U.S. rogue state. And again, folks, this is not just hyperbole. The five bullet points that are listed at the top of this BlackAllianceForPeace.com newsletter are all verifiable, historically relevant, and happening right before our very eyes. And final point here, Ajamu, folks, it's your tax dollars that are being used to fund all of this foolishness. They're taking the money out of your pocket and using it for these types of hegemonic actions. This stuff does not come at doesn't come for free. So again, BlackAllianceForPeace.com is where you go to read more. Ajamu Baraka, stay safe, stay healthy. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Is there a disinformation campaign aimed to justify the assassination of Qasem Soleimani by painting him and Iran as willing enablers of al-Qaeda? The propaganda operation relied heavily on a shoddily sourced book, The Exile, according to my next guest. He's an independent investigative journalist who has covered national security policy since 2005 and was the recipient of the Gellhorn Prize for Journalism in 2012. His most recent book is The CIA Insider's Guide to the Iran Crisis, co-authored by our own John Kiriakou, and it was just published in February. He is Gareth Porter. Welcome to the Critical Hour.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be on.
Thank you for joining us. You opened this Gray Zone Project piece by writing, quote, "The U.S. assassination of Qasem Soleimani in January touched off a new wave of disinformation about the top Iranian major general, with Trump administration allies branding him a global terrorist while painting Iran as the world's worst state sponsor of terrorism. Much of the propaganda about Soleimani related to his alleged responsibility for the killing of American troops in Iraq, along with Iran's role in Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen," end quote. Take it from there. Talk about this, please.
Sure. Well, that what you just described is really familiar, I think, to most of your listeners. That is the U.S. official propaganda that has been particularly strong, but didn't begin with the Trump administration, against Iran and Qasem Soleimani for the role that they played in Iraq during the U.S. Occupation of the country, and more recently in other countries in the Middle East, where Iran has allies and has provided assistance in the form of weapons, training, and other advice. And this has been basically categorized as terrorism on the part of Iran, and that is blatantly sort of misrepresenting the entire context in which this is going on. But my piece really talks about a very different line of propaganda that has now appeared since the assassination of General Soleimani, which is the notion that has been peddled by not that many sources, but some very prominent ones in both British and American media, that General Soleimani was responsible for having enabled the horrible al-Qaeda terrorist Musab al-Zarqawi in killing the Shiites in Iraq during the early phase of the Iraq War. Now, that was a charge that is so preposterous that one would imagine that it would be difficult to get away with the idea of trying to push it. But nevertheless, that is exactly what we've been getting now out of the London Times, Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, and the Public Radio of the United States. These are all media that have been putting forward the point of view that has been based entirely on a book that was published in 2017 by two British journalists called The Exile. And in that book, they unspool this tale of how the Iranians and Soleimani took in al-Qaeda operatives after their escape from Afghanistan in 2001, late 2001, and basically enabled them in general. And Zarqawi, the notorious terrorist within Iraq, who was responsible then for helping to start the Islamic State from Iraq and moving it to Syria, which did move to Syria later, the propaganda campaign has portrayed Soleimani as giving him aid and comfort and helping him move from Iran into Iraq as early as 2001, 2002. So my piece basically deconstructs that whole story and points out that this is fundamentally at odds with what is well known about the al-Qaeda presence in Iran beginning in late 2001, which was that there was a relatively small group of people, 100, 150 people, who entered Iran legally with passports and were allowed to stay temporarily. It was understood that there would not be a permanent stay by any means because they had been refugees from the war in Afghanistan. They were known to be al-Qaeda. There was no ambiguity about that. But they were told that they would have to be non-political. They would have to avoid meetings using their cell phones. They could not do anything that had the slightest hint of plotting for operations outside of Iran. And those were the terms under which they were allowed to stay temporarily. Then there was a second group, a much larger group of military people who entered Iran illegally, clandestinely. And those people included Zarqawi. And so they tried their best to avoid being detected by the Iranian intelligence and security people and hung out with Sunni sympathizers, many of whom, most of whom were really not Iranian, but other ethnic groups within Iran. And they did believe that they were managing to evade them. But in fact, the Iranians used their surveillance of the legally present al-Qaeda to do their best to get more information, more intelligence on the whereabouts of the clandestine al-Qaeda people. And that's one of the ways in which they finally were able to track them down. And I say finally, but actually they did so quite quickly after the arrival of the legally present al-Qaeda people in Iran. Within a few months, they had begun to make arrests in 2002. And in 2003, they had a major crackdown, which netted some 80% of the military personnel who were part of Zarqawi's group. And according to a top-level al-Qaeda person who was swept up in that in those raids, who gave his own personal memoir about what happened, it really confused their plans and essentially frustrated, as he put it, 75% of their plan surrounding Zarqawi. So there's absolutely no doubt that the Iranians had no intention of allowing any terrorism to take place from Iranian soil. They had no desire, no interest in helping Zarqawi. This was all a complete lie. And I point out in my piece that there's a specialist on al-Qaeda who had been at the West Point Center for Counterterrorism named Nellie LaHood, who had given a, first of all, she had read around more than 300 of the secret documents that were found in bin Laden's home after he was killed by U.S. Special Forces, and had translated them herself and was able to basically provide the most expert opinion on what one could learn from those documents. And what she said was that it's very clear from those documents that the clandestine Iranians knew that the clandestine Al-Qaeda, excuse me, in Iran knew very well that the Iranians did not know they were there, and that indeed, if the Iranians caught them, it would be extremely dangerous for them. They were even given instructions on how to commit suicide if they were caught, because they knew that the Iranians would not treat them very mildly. So the evidence on this whole story is extremely powerful, that this is completely made up, and it's just an egregious exercise in misinformation, disinformation.
We have just about 1 minute left. Is the preposterous nature of the Soleimani-Zarqawi connection as preposterous as the Saddam Hussein-Osama bin Laden connection was back as they were trying to give a rationale for September 11?
Well, they're about the same level of preposterousness, I would say.
That's my question.
I mean, they were both made up.
That's my question. And in another 30 seconds, and this might sound kind of juvenile or sophomoric, but what's the actual benefit for making these ridiculous connections? What's the upside in doing this? 30 seconds.
Well, what they're about here is to demonize the entire Iranian government in general and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, of which Soleimani was the chief of Quds Force in particular. And that has all kinds of, from their point of view, that has all kinds of benefits having to do with sort of making various things illegal and being able to punish people for any connection with the IRGC.
And rationalizing the assassination of General Soleimani.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, obviously he does that.
Right.
Yes, it's part of that.
Well, yeah. Gareth Porter, thank you so much for your time. Greatly, greatly appreciated. Fantastic piece. And I look forward that you can find in the Gray Zone. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.